Welcome to Opera Out of the Box, unpacking opera piece by piece. I'm your host, Brad Cresswell, and we have a special edition of our podcast with the Toledo Opera to talk about the loss of federal funding and the impact on arts organizations in our community, in our state. I'm joined by Toledo Opera's Leah Whitaker, Mark Folk, who is President and CEO of the Arts Commission, and on the phone we have the Ohio Humanities Executive Director, Rebecca Asmo. Welcome to all of you.
Hi, Brad.
Hi, Brad.
Thank you.
Well, we're talking about federal funding, and it's kind of hard to talk about that because there's so much going on at the present time with federal funding. We're waiting for, on the radio side or on the public media side, we're waiting to see if the Senate passes the rescission letter, clawing back money, basically, for FY26 and FY27. So it's an existential threat for us. It's kind of confusing, I know. It's confusing me as we speak. But maybe we'll talk about how federal funding works for your organizations. And we'll start with you, Rebecca. You want to tell us a little bit about your work and how it has affected and will affect you in the future?
Absolutely. Well, thanks for having me on today, Brad. Ohio Humanities is the state-based partner of the National Endowment for the Humanities, and we are one of 56 state and jurisdictional humanities councils that's, in every state and every territory. And we receive, much like the arts councils do, an appropriation from Congress that is allocated to each of us according to our state's population. And, each of our councils are 501c3 organizations, so we are a little bit different from arts councils, which are state agencies. And all of the councils are a little bit different, but the allocation from the National Endowment for the humanities and that operating grant is a really important part of our operating budget. About 5 years ago, before I came to the organization, it was about 99% of our budget.
Wow.
And at the time that the grants were canceled by DOGE at NEH, it's about 85% of our budget. Mm. So while we're working to diversify funding, it's a significant loss. And what happened at the federal level was on April 2nd, 2025, in the middle of the night, all of the state humanities councils and any grantee who had an open grant at the National Endowment for the Humanities received an email in the middle of the night in our spam folders, abruptly canceling contracts and a relationship that we have had with the National Endowment for the Humanities for over 50 years. Wow. And so what that means is, in a state like Ohio, where the primary focus of Ohio Humanities was to pass through most of our funding to organizations that serve the public, like the Toledo Opera, projects like Opera Out of the Box, which we absolutely loved supporting. But immediately the primary source of our grant program was taken away. Hmm. And so, that is, that's really the biggest impact. But long term, this is just a huge interruption in the incredible work that really partners like all of you and many others in the Toledo community do to, bring great programs to the public.
Well, let's talk with you, Mark. And how does the funding, federal funding, affect the Arts Commission?
It impacts us in a variety of ways. Locally, if you look across organizations, I think the clawback that happened with Children's Theater Workshop was the only one that actively had their funding evaporate. And I think it's really important to point out for the NEA grants that they're a reimbursement. So you have to expend the dollars before you're reimbursed for them through the NEA grant-making portfolio. So any organization across the state that had a grant that was clawed back from them had already had the outlay of cash and was instantly put into a situation where they were in a deficit. The National Endowment for the Arts, just like the National Endowment for Humanities, is currently under attack. I think the important framing on this is, Rebecca pointed out, is there, with the exception of New Hampshire, which has been just, I believe, taken down either to a dollar or to just pay their executive director salary, every state in the union has a state arts council. 40% of the National Endowment's budget, which was about $209 million last year, is dedicated to the states. And then the states will fund that on a one-to-one match. So it's a requirement from the federal government that the state puts up one-to-one. So 40% of the states in the union just get the flat match. So if the NEA funding evaporates, one would imagine 40% of the state arts councils across the United States could go away as well, yeah. Which would be a massive impact. That matters a lot in a community like Toledo. We are the only major metropolitan area in the state of Ohio without another dedicated funding stream for arts and culture. So if you're over in Cuyahoga County, they have a tobacco excise tax. That I think at its lowest year was funding $12 million for arts and culture just in Cuyahoga County alone. Arts Wave down in Cincinnati, it's the longest workplace giving campaign in the United States. Akron is a night city. Wherever the Knight Brothers had a newspaper, there's a foundation to help support the social infrastructure there. Columbus is hotel, motel, and ticket tax. So for us in Northwest Ohio, the money that comes back through the Ohio Arts Council, the Ohio Humanities Council, is the largest common funder of cultural programming, general operating support, and is really vital. So if that gets fully zeroed out at some point in the future, it's going to have a devastating impact on a lot of our organizations.
Yeah.
I think there are, for us, actually, our real risk, about $250,000 of vulnerability, actually comes from HUD, Housing and Urban Development. We employ our young artists at work apprentices through job and family service dollars that come from HUD, through community development block grants that come through HUD. So it's not just the arts ecosystem that's vulnerable right now. It's frankly anything that's focused on public service you're seeing put to threat at the federal level. And it's daunting. I know I was talking with colleagues at the NEA just 3 weeks ago. 70% of their employees were either pushed into a buyout or let go because they were new employees. It's 50% of the workforce at that agency. And you really think about the human capital that walks out the door when these cuts are made. You know, we've just had a generational loss of knowledge and relationships and efficacy walk out of the organization. It could take another generation to build that back.
Wow.
Mark makes a really important point about, other agencies and sectors being impacted. We talked about NEA, we talked about NEH, but the Institute of Museum and Library Services really faced a similar decimation to the National Endowment for the Humanities. And then also things like historic preservation funding has been very disrupted because of attempts to freeze funding at the National Park Service. And so we really look at this as like all of the, you know, cultural funding at the federal level is really frozen, under attack, or has the potential to be frozen in the immediate future. And, it really could be quite devastating.
Yeah, yeah, you take that one step further even with the Library of Congress where copyright is licensing takes place. That's all your artistic intellectual property that's being threatened as well.
Yeah.
Well, traditionally, the CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, pays our music licensing fees. Mm-hmm. So if they're zeroed out, what do we do? You know, that it's a question because a lot of radio stations play music, and they won't be able to unless they pay the licensing fees themselves to do that. And so that's an undue burden that we're facing as well, along with all the other cuts. That's something that people don't think about very often, but it's true. And we're urging the public to make phone calls and send emails and all of that. It's a dire situation. I mean, do you think it's been reflected a little bit in the nationwide trend towards the arts and the humanities? Do you see that slipping at all, talking about your public?
I think the arts and humanities are where people are still engaging. You know, I think about the definition of civic space is where strangers come together. And I think that arts and culture have a really unique opportunity to help support that. I mean, just a few months, it's been such a drastic paradigm shift. I was invited a year ago in January to the Healing Bridging Thriving Summit put together by the National Endowment for the Arts, where in the last presidential administration, there was a mandate that every cabinet-level position in the federal government had a relationship with arts programming and was supporting arts programming. So it was full cloth a part of American life. And now we're watching that all be unwound in the present tense. So I'm really curious to see what public audience trends will be moving forward, whether we'll see a rally, you know, like we did with the pandemic and public sport coming together, or whether people will be forced to really look at their, you know, their essential needs as human beings that are, you know, costs are increasing and what that will do to the sector. I think the confounding part of this is historically when we've gone through a housing crisis or a global pandemic, we've been able to rely on our federal government to help us out and get through those challenges. And in this moment, it's the federal government that's causing them.
Rebecca, do you want to say anything to that? I mean, how has the arts degraded in the public eye over the past year or so?
Well, I think that, you know, I don't really want to say that it's degraded because I think that, you know, people and communities value the arts and humanities. They tell us that, surveys tell us that, you know, we know that opportunities to come together, opportunities to understand the human condition, and opportunities to understand one another, people value that and people really want that. What has become really challenging in the past year is, you know, the attention economy, and then also, you know, truly every single day you're flooded with so much information. You can't possibly, as a human, keep track of it all. It's it's absolutely impossible. And so that's the biggest risk, and that is what could potentially degrade us. But I really want to push back against the messaging of these are lean times. You know, the public isn't interested. You know, the degradation of the arts and culture sector. Because, you know, I walk around all the time and see just, you know, people valuing arts and culture in the farthest flung corners of the state, in communities and areas that it might even surprise people coming from a large metropolitan area. And so I think that when we're given that narrative that money for culture is needed for something else, you know, that scarcity mindset, I think, is done to try to, you know, trick us into submission. And so I want us to all push back and that, you know, we need the arts, we need culture, we need humanities to have a thriving economy and to have a thriving society.
Are you scared of other funding cuts like to Medicaid obscuring your message to the public?
Well, I think, look, I'm, you know, and actually I, before I came to Ohio Humanities, I spent a long career at the Boys and Girls Clubs. And, you know, all funding that supports, you know, citizens just living a good life and having access to basic needs is really important to me personally. I've seen, you know, how much it makes a difference in a family's life. But if we're also talking about some of the impacts to these cuts to the social service sector and what I'm watching, you know, happen to my friends who are leading those organizations in my community, is that, you know, they're seeing cuts to their organizations. You know, philanthropy is trying to figure out how can they cover, you know, and try to fill the gap. At the same time, corporate giving to the arts is not increasing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's actually decreasing. And so all of these, every single one of these actions and occurrences has a negative impact on the cultural sector, certainly, but really just on our community fabric as a whole.
Yeah. Leah, you've been very quiet thus far.
I'm weeping. I'm over here weeping.
Right. How has the federal funding, the situations that we're talking about now, how has it affected Toledo Opera? You're involved in finance, mm-hmm. so you would know.
I think when you get all of these big ideas on the ground level, where the rubber meets the road, each organization is going to have a different flavor or experience of all of this, but nobody is immune. I think as the chief fundraiser for an arts organization of our size, number one, our size is almost a benefit. We're very tiny. We're a scrappy little team, and we don't generally need to rely on federal funding to operate successfully. That being said, with cuts everywhere, across deep cuts across the board, and you mentioned HUD, Mark, and I want to throw in the food banks.
Mm-hmm.
All the social services organizations are experiencing these things simultaneously, and so the pressure is on smaller foundations. It's on the Toledo Community Foundation. So it does feel, the more you think and exist in this mindset, I can see how a lot of people would adopt the scarcity mindset, that what our limited resources are getting even more pressured. So whether or not it's coming from the federal, from a federal grant, or from the state Ohio Arts Council, we in the fundraising world know that everybody's getting asked way more than they normally have, and these foundations don't have the resources, and private philanthropy, frankly, does not have it in them to replicate what the federal government was doing. So everybody is waiting. I think everybody in the nonprofit world is holding their breath and just waiting for us to get kicked off the cliff, too. So I'm always trying to find silver linings and things, and I have to say that when you talk about arts and humanities, the culture, those things are irrepressible human forces. Mm. And the more pressure and containment and confinement and censorship and regulation that is put on these very natural human forces of expression, the more the violent reaction will become. And that is not to sound like threatening or anything. I just know that in countercultural movements, when you push things underground, they don't disappear. So these very purposeful threats to public service spaces and the place where middle class and poor people exist, the more pressure and heat that's put on them, and the more the resistance will grow to this. So there is, in some sense, it's going to force, the issue will be forced at some point, and I think the public is on the sides of the arts and the humanities.
Yeah.
And, in my personal life, I've been on the streets in protest, and it's probably not something that I should admit on air, but, I see the age groups of people who are out on the streets, too, and they're my parents' generation. It's still, it's people of a certain age also, I think, looking reflectively on their legacy and what they can still leave behind. And as a fundraiser, I just encourage, invest in endowments, invest in things that are not going to go away, strengthen these organizations, make these organizations future-proof. If you can't rely on state budgets and you can't rely on the federal government, it really is going to have to be people of a certain age and generation leaving large gifts to these institutions to keep them going.
Well, what can a general member of the public do right now? I mean, we're telling people to call and email their congresspeople or their senators and, affect them that way. It's timed with whatever votes they have going on, whatever, rescission or the big beautiful bill or mm-hmm. all that stuff. That's happening. We're still, like you, we're waiting for the third and fourth shoes to drop,
right,
as we go along. But what can we, what should our messaging be to the public right now?
I think that, you know, Brad, there's so many things that individuals can do. Leah talked about giving, right? So there's, of course, giving major gifts to things like endowments, but you could just sign up to give a monthly gift, right? A $5 monthly gift. I mean, just, you know, making sure that you're making consistent contributions to organizations. On a national level, you can join an organization like Americans for the Arts or the Arts Action Fund, which is gives out great information. You know, also joining your local public radio or public television station, you're going to get great information about how you can engage. But I do think it's important to note about how many Americans and don't engage civically in our elections. And so not just the presidential elections, because we're talking a lot about what happens at the federal level, but when you get down to the state level, that's incredibly important, but it's also important at the local level. And when you're getting to things like primary elections and the things that really do decide the local candidates, the state candidates, that can influence so much about the resources that are going to be available for any public good that you appreciate. You know, there are some primary elections in our state that get 8% turnout, 16% turnout. You know, it's quite low. And so I do think in this country, you know, to come from a humanities person, I think it's really important that we not just engage with our legislators once they're in their seats in whatever office that they're in, but we really need to think about who we're selecting to go into those offices and ask them the questions about what they care about. Americans for the Arts publishes a really great report card about many different arts-related and culture-related issues. That's a great thing to check out and see, you know, where your, you know, federal legislators stand. But I also think, you know, really making sure that you're showing up for every opportunity, you know, to weigh in is very important.
Mark, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I have so many thoughts, but I just to the point of building relationships now. You don't get the resources when you just go in with a cold ask. You go in and you learn about your elected officials' values, whether that's the city, the county, the state, the federal level. You listen to what their values are, and then you align the arts case with that and advocate for resources. And you start building those relationships now. I think that's the most important thing we can do. You know, Rebecca and I were at the Americans for the Arts conference a couple weeks ago in Cincinnati, and Maribel Perez Wadsworth was on the stage, and she gave a quote that the power of change is not lost, it's local. You know, and that's just resonated with me over and over again. And while our North Stars are being dimmed or dismantled, we have an opportunity to rewire our constellations, build relationships, and make sure that we're relaying information to ourselves in a way that we need it so we can, you know, we can grow. And one of the ways you can do that is as simple as showing up to an arts and cultural event, buying a ticket or going to a free event, and being in community with people and having conversations.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of what we're doing is we're getting people to, you know, call or email their congresspeople, but also to get them to help shore up our budget a little bit. You know, we've had a lot of reaction as far as people that are out there that, you know, it's like preaching to the choir. You're telling them, and they're telling you, you know, don't let this federal funding, what happens to the radio station, what happens to the TV station, education department, without funding. And we try to put them at ease, but we're saying, you know, people donate as much as you can. But I'm wondering if your organizations foresee kind of people building you up financially in the future. I mean, if this goes on.
We all hope so, right? But I think it depends on your relationships and how your stewardship has been with previous gifts you've received and your case making for your supporters and the way you serve the public. I think it's going to be what I've witnessed going through these moments is the large and mid-sized organizations in our community always weather the storm fine. It's the smaller organizations that are community-based or art form specifically based or ethnically based that always face the toughest challenges and get tested the most on their resiliency in these moments.
Yeah.
As I think about what people can do, and it goes back to Rebecca, you mentioned the attention economy. Part of what I get, not frustrated, because I'm still very new to the arts. One of the things that I think we tend to be a little too highbrow, and we only communicate in spaces we're comfortable in as organizations. And I think about, you know, in Toledo, Rebecca, we have a Mud Hen Stadium, within a couple of blocks. It's a professional baseball team within a couple blocks of our historic Valentine Theater. And in the opera world, you know, we'd love to see attendance, like families come out to baseball games and have that kind of reception. And one of the things that I notice is that, you know, and I think that our marketing director at Toledo Opera does this very well, is talk to the public where they are having conversations. And she, Rachel Cameron, who's sitting here in the studio, is really gifted at understanding algorithms and understanding how virality takes place and becoming, really leveraging these tools because the relational piece is so essential, but people are conducting, finding, and nurturing those relationships more and more in a digital framework that really is managed and controlled by algorithms. And to understand the space, like, it's almost like the arts, the humanities, the cultural organizations need to find some like big national marketing campaign and put out issue ads that are going viral, that are speaking to people in these digital languages with the video clips that are snarky and edgy. And you've got to get the young people to talk to them in their language about why this is essential to them. It's also about, using the right tools to tell the story, I think, is really important. And one of the reasons I'm going to plug our podcast, Brad, bringing the story of opera was a big leap for us to come from a main stage production setting with costumes and put the story in a podcast form that can go on a radio station and then be downloaded on Spotify. Like, that was a big change for us. But I think the more that these organizations in their adaptability planning start to look at communication tools and how to use them effectively, it can work within your budget. You can be very nimble and smart and sophisticated about getting your message out there where people are listening.
Yeah, and that's something we're struggling with now, trying to reach a younger audience. You know, how
it's
do you do that?
It's all about the algorithm. It's the algorithms, and you have to pay for those algorithms. You have to pay for them.
Leah, that flexibility that you talk about is so important, but I also think you are reevaluating your value proposition to the community, right? Because that has to shift too. And we're doing that at Ohio Humanities. And, you know, for 50 years, and this is happening all across the country, you know, we were pretty comfortable just, you know, taking this allocation, passing it through to, organizations who serve the public. It was a relatively simple formula. But we have to start asking ourselves a question, what do we look like if there's no National Endowment for the Humanities, you know, as it used to exist? And so, you know, a couple years ago when I first came to the organization, you know, I was digging into data. Well, you know, Ohio is one of only 10 states where the state legislature doesn't support the State Humanities Council. Mm-hmm. Well, that's an opportunity. You know, as a result of that, you know, we rank 49th out of 50 states in the District of Columbia in per capita funding for the public humanities. And what that means on the ground is that, you know, hundreds, about 450 local history organizations have no access to any sort of statewide cultural funding. And so those are challenges that we've been working on. You know, certainly the urgency is heightened in this moment. But I think that what our value proposition is in this moment is how do we get our sector, the humanities sector, which, you know, sometimes people even wonder, what is that? How do we come together to speak with one voice and become more powerful and stop
coalition
trying
building.
To explain what we are, define what we are, and really demand the resources that we need to bring, you know, value and culture and, you know, economic development, but also, you know, joy to communities large and small across the state.
I wonder how you future-proof against that, or how do you protect yourself in this environment?
Well, I think if I'll start, just since, you know, we had such a huge portion of our budget really overnight just cut off.
Disappearing, yeah.
And while it did happen overnight, you know, honestly, we were preparing for it for a couple of years. And I started in this role exactly 4 years ago, and you know, it was immediately clear, well, we can't just have all of our revenue coming from this one source, right. Especially in a moment when, you know, it was harder for Congress to pass budgets. They were relying more on continuing resolutions. And so we started to put together a plan that put away, you know, any money that came in, you know, that wasn't restricted, that wasn't federal money, and it, you know, really began going into reserves. We continued to build our endowment, which was there, thought about things like passive income. And so, you know, we also put together a trigger plan that if we were to ever lose income, whether it was a government shutdown for a period of time or something more drastic, you know, we were ready to go. And then in November, when we, you know, after the election, and we sensed, okay, we think some things are going to be pretty different than they were in the past, you know, we made some changes to our operations so that when April 2nd happened, and honestly, we couldn't have predicted it was going to, you know, go down the way that it did, but we were actually really well prepared. And, you know, that's giving us a lot of opportunity and a long runway to think about, you know, how do we shift, how do we pivot in this moment and, you know, change the operating model and change the revenue model.
Yeah.
And so, cause that's going to take some time. So planning ahead is one, and that's difficult and that's hard to do, but, you know, really making sure that in every single budget, you've got some surplus there to put some stuff aside. And I think also really talking to your donors. I mean, I know donors love to fund something very tangible. Well, I think in this moment, it's really easy to show them, you know, why it is so important to have unrestricted dollars, because it is very tangible in this moment, you know, the value of that kind of funding.
Mark, you've been scribbling in your notebook there. I wonder if you have something to add.
Yeah, I mean, I think those are all great points, but they infer some type of capacity to be able to do that. When we look at the, you know, we were able to get the city and county to join together and put together $6 million of their ARPA funding so we could help our organizations and artists recover from the pandemic. And going through that exercise, you know, we tried to get to everyone was out there. We estimated it was around 50, 52 organizations. We were able to fund 44. Six of them are above $2 million, nine of them between $300,000 and $2 million, and then 32 organizations under a $300,000 annual operating budget, some much, much smaller. And in those instances, where they can work to diversify their income, their executive directors, their marketing person, who's also the janitor, who's doing all these different things. So ideally, some kind of stabilized structural funding would be ideal. That has always proven elusive. You know, Toledo was the most corporate-rich community in Ohio up until the late 80s and early 90s, so it never developed that kind of structural infrastructure, because that's a redundant word, structural infrastructure, but because the business community was always there to support. So it's a challenge that I think about all the time, and how do we make sure that our smaller organizations are protected as we go through times like this.
Is there a way in the local, like county spaces? I just actually got up from a coffee date with one of our county commissioners, Lisa Sobecki, and she was talking about, you know, the challenges of different counties and allocating resources is that the Northwest Ohio counties aren't necessarily organized on their same, like they're not asking for the same things, and that if we did more coalition building
from the state
into some of the state reserves and the rainy day funds.
Mark, you make such a good point. And you know, when you look holistically at arts and culture funding, you know, funding for history, you know, collectively in the state of Ohio per capita, because we have a really huge population in Ohio, we're the seventh most populous state, you know, we actually really underfund culture. So even though the State Arts Council is one of the larger arts councils, you know, there are some large, you know, local arts councils. When you look, put it all together, you know, states like West Virginia or Nebraska, even though they're much smaller than us, you know, per person, they're investing a lot more in telling their story and in funding organizations. One of the challenges that I see in it, I mean, we have so many large cities in Ohio, and I think, like, I was looking this up the other day, and it's something like we rank third in, like, the most number of major metro areas. And so what often happens is, you know, cities are really focused on their, you know, their cities, and we don't tend, you know, like Leah said, to kind of work across communities and build coalitions. And, you know, I do agree there needs to be, you know, a much larger source of funding for culture and a much more sustainable source of funding, you know, really at all levels, but certainly at the state level.
I want to ask you and Mark, Rebecca, if the public doesn't do anything, if this comes to the worst case scenario, where do you see your organizations in 5 years down the road? I mean, what's the future, the pessimistic future of your,
what's the worst case scenario here?
Yeah.
What's doomsday?
You want to start with that, Mark?
Sure. First of all, I'm not scared. I'm not scared of what's coming ahead. We're going to fight. Culture is fluid. Policy is fixed. And what we're dealing with now is fixed policy. But that doesn't change the way that our people express culture and embrace the arts.
Right.
So I think it's as eternal as the human spirit, and it's going to be there along the way. Maybe I need to think that way to survive, but I truly believe it all the way to my core. In the worst case scenario, we contract and then we reimagine ourselves. You know, Rebecca brought up the business model. You know, I'm really curious about what are future business models for arts and culture. The nonprofit sector was created and then proliferated, and it creates an environment where we're annually vulnerable, where we have to annually justify our value. And I want to daydream and dream about what different versions of our business model could look like, where we have more stability. And instead of thinking about where next year's money's coming from, it's what is next year's impact on the communities that entrust us to be in leadership roles. So we'll buckle down, you know, if we have to contract some things. We'll also pivot. For our organization, every time we've hit a major crisis, again, with the exception of this one being caused by the federal government, we've been able to serve more deeply, grow our relationships, build our trust, ultimately grow our budget. And I think a lot of those pathways are going to be by looking for where we have value outside of the arts and culture sector.
What are some of those areas, do you think?
I mean, in the housing crisis, all but one of the community development corporations in Toledo collapsed. So we used our role as a local arts agency and a community building agency to launch a strategic plan for arts and culture for the city. We asked neighborhoods to allow us to be guests. We incorporated their data, their stories into the overall plan, but also put individual neighborhood reports in there so they can in turn go after funding. And that allowed us to use arts and culture as a way to convene people to articulate how they wanted their communities to advance in the absence of a traditional infrastructure, that then those communities rebuilt that infrastructure in a new way, and our role wasn't relevant there anymore, so we stepped into another space. Yeah. So I think it's, we have great fluidity in culture. Culture is human, you know, and I think there's always going to be a way.
Yeah. Well, you're
and,
an optimist.
Like, culture is in everything, it's in right? Everything. Like Mark, I'm actually optimistic too, and I think optimism is key to any sort of resistance. So I think that's important to remember. If you get, you know, too angry, and not that there's not things to be angry about, or too mired in hopelessness, it's really hard to have the energy to fight back. Yeah. But what Mark's talking about is, like, arts and culture are not siloed or segmented from our life. They're a part of every part of our life. You know, I saw that when I was at the Boys and Girls Clubs. Like, everything that we did was better when it was fully infused with arts and humanities. And so we have to start, you know, in every area of society, I think, requiring that culture is a part of that, because it makes everything better. And so, you know, I'm also optimistic. I read a lot of history, and I encourage people to read history, because you'll also see that, you know, we really have been here before, and it wasn't very long ago, you know, that America has been through this before. Yeah. And so for some of us, like, you know, for me at 45 years old, a lot of this might feel unprecedented. But we've got, you know, elders in our community today, you know, alive today, who, you know, have been through this before, and we can learn lessons from them. And, you know, so I think we also really need to look inward and look to America's past and see what we can learn from that and apply it to this moment that we're in. And that always makes me feel hopeful too, because, you know, we've done it before many times.
So we've been talking about federal cuts, intentional federal cuts, and budget issues at the same time that at the same time AI technology is roaring full steam ahead.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we're also adding to that huge industry changes, and the arts and humanities are not immune to potential job loss in this industry just from AI changes. That being said, if organizations like Mark's and Rebecca's become frontline AI adapter, companion, ambassador, helping usher in this brand new technology, which is fundamentally going to redefine what we think of as culture and humanities and human relationships, adapt early to survive is one of the things that I would say, that the more that we can get into understanding what's coming to us in real sort of existential threats from technology, I think that's also going to be a very rich, productive, honestly, a lot more near term than we think it's going to be. Coming at us, I think that that's also another way that the arts and humanities and the cultural places of society can maybe survive if we adapt earlier.
Yeah. I mean, of it either as a tool or as, you know.
Well, there are going to be ethical and moral conversations around the widespread use of AI. It's going to be in all of our public spaces. It's going to be not only in arts organizations and nonprofit space, it's going to be in political and policy spaces. It's going to be in.
But what do we lose and what do we gain from that?
Well, there. Imagine a new corporation that's fully adopted AI, and they have to define just sort of the working relationship between the human staff and the AI tools and the robots that are coming. Yeah. essentially will be conversations around this. And people as human beings will pull from the arts and humanities to define their center point, to define their morals, their ethics, their understanding of the world. So we also have an opportunity to really define, we're going to be redefining all these things in the next 5 to 10 years. Words are going to mean different. Culture is going to mean something completely different 10 years from now.
Hopefully I won't be here.
Well, hopefully you will.
Well, I was going to say, there's a great book called Nexus by Yuval Noah Harari that talks about exactly that. And how we really are going to need, historians of religion, philosophers, ethicists, to make sure that we don't destroy humanity. We're really facing the existential threats, but I agree, that's why we're all needed. More than ever.
Well, not to be blindsided by it. I think, when you're in the arts and humanities and nonprofit space, you're kind of like the last to find out about what's coming. I think that, we've all just come out of a pandemic that we miraculously survived and get no credit for. But thank you, Mark, for helping the opera survive with that ARPA funding. We have just come out of, that was a test case of what's to come. And I think if we take those same learning lessons about adaptability, use of technology, early adaption, how we define communal spaces and things like that, and take those lessons forward, we are that much more prepared and resilient.
Yeah. I think it's about constellating, too.
Ooh, tell us what that means.
Just building networks, building awareness. Mm-hmm. I have my role at the Arts Commission. I'm co-chair of the Urban Arts Coalition, which is the top populated 100 cities in the United States with local arts agencies. I meet with my peers from Indy, Detroit, Columbus, Cleveland, and Pittsburgh on a regular basis. I am a founding member of a collaborative called Goldenrod with a bunch of West Coast local arts agency people who now have all these different roles, serving on the Grant Makers in the Arts Public Sector Cultural Policy Task Force. And I do it all because it's important to Toledo, because I can interact with different people, different ideas, different forms of research. I can learn about how Patrick Fisher in Pittsburgh is using AI to help their grant, the people they support through their grants program, by using AI to visualize data. So the organization will know at what point of its financial cycle that year that their cash flow will run short and they can plan ahead. They'll know how much money they need to raise the next dollar on average for their organization. There's a way to use AI and some of these other tools to really help our business models be more efficient, so our storytelling can be more efficient, so we have more time connecting with people to ask for their support or to impact their lives and connect them to our organization. So they'll want to feed it so other people can benefit from the same things.
I imagine that those tools are more important to smaller organizations as well.
Probably, and they're probably the most elusive to secure. So I think, organizations like Rebecca's and like mine, we fill this interstitial role, right? We're the things that help keep things connected to each other so culture can be diverse. And we can understand where the greater needs are and secure resources to try to help build ecosystems up.
Yeah. So we're running out of time. I'm going to ask you each one question. The kudos to Leah for providing a list of questions for me, most of which I didn't say, but I appreciate it anyway. The question is, what gives you hope right now in the fight to preserve and promote arts and humanities? Maybe, Rebecca, you want to start with that?
What gives me hope are the people and the communities that are working so hard every single day to preserve and amplify and tell just the extraordinary stories that define Ohio's history, culture, and people. And, last week I had the chance to attend the groundbreaking for a new Underground Railroad Museum that's opening in Morristown, Ohio, in Belmont County, right on the West Virginia border in Appalachia. And it was incredible. Just, I mean, it was years and years of work that people in that community have done to bring that project to fruition. And that is what gives me hope every single day.
I'm going to echo and say it's people. I mean, I have a freshman, recently completed freshman from college at home, who's studying history and recording technology at the same time, who I see a sense of hope and even in the face of darkness, preparing themselves for the future that's ahead. So I always find a lot of light in young people. And then I was just last week in Washington, D.C. for a convening of the Americans for the Arts, where they drew together 30 researchers from across the United States who were looking at how do we protect the data that's been gathered so it can be useful in the future. And in that constellation of people, I saw collaboration, I saw hope, I saw a deep commitment to iterate what the future looks like and really help drive the sector forward. So my hope lies in people. And hope at this point feels like an act of resistance and one that we can really lean into.
You've been listening to Opera Out of the Box, a co-production of WGTE Public Media and Toledo Opera. You can find previous episodes online at our website, WGTE.org. And of course, you can dive into all things Toledo Opera at their website, ToledoOpera.org. I want to thank my guests today, Rebecca Asmo, Mark Folk, and Leah Whitaker. I'm your host, Brad Cresswell, and this has been Opera Out of the Box.